If God actually exists, then why is the evidence so questionable and contested?
Well, hello, everybody. I want to start today with this big idea. It's in the form of a question. What if it's actually more rational to believe that God exists than that he does not? You see, often people will think the opposite, that if you investigate the evidence, that it'll soon become very clear that the idea of God is just a fairy tale made up by people who don't know any better or who need some kind of emotional crutch to get through their less than exciting lives. But what if we follow the evidence and we find that it leads us to the idea of belief in God as a logical conclusion? Anthony Flew, he was a hardened atheist, Oxford professor. He traveled the world debating theists, people who believe in God. He became one of the leading atheist voices of the 20th century. He was brilliant. Before he died, Flew wrote a book titled There Is a God, in which he retired his atheism. He said this, "Atheism is no longer a logical, tenable, or defensible position to hold." You see, the deeper he went into the evidence, he realized that it pointed toward the existence of God and not away from it. So is there a God or not? This is the key question that we want to explore today. And we're wrestling with some other big questions about faith all this month. I'm so glad that you've joined us today. And I want to personally welcome you, especially if you're a guest this week. As I mentioned last week, you overcame a lot of noise to be here. The idea that all Christians are hypocrites, that all Christians are tied to a certain political figure, that all churches are just after your money, all this kind of stuff. There's a lot of noise out there. And it says a lot about you to fight through all the noise and say, you know what, I'm open-minded enough to consider something else, a different perspective. So thank you for being here. We're honored that you've joined us. Now, usually the key source of evidence that we use around here on a Sunday morning is the Bible. We go there early and often. We chop it up. We underline things. We really dig into the Bible. But today, for some of you, the Bible isn't a source of authority in your life. And so my appeal to the Christian scriptures today wouldn't do much for you. Plus, with today's subject matter, the existence of God, if we use the Bible as our main source of evidence, the message will become very circular very fast. For example, it would go something like this. How do we know that God exists? Well, the Bible says he does. Well, why should we trust the Bible? Because God says we should. See, it goes in circles. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we're going to look at some evidence today outside of the Bible, although we're still going to weave in some truth from the scriptures. But I want to give credit before we begin to Mark Clark, who wrote the book, The Problem of God, that's the foundation for this whole series. A lot of the material that we're using is found in or inspired by his book. I'd encourage you to buy a copy of your own. And if you're a first-time guest today, you can pick up a free copy after the services as our thank you for just being here. So today we're talking about the existence of God. What proofs and clues are there that an all-powerful, eternal being actually exists? And if the evidence is there, we must follow it wherever it leads and then have the courage to rethink our beliefs and to live our lives accordingly. Renowned philosopher Alvin Plantinga points out that there are some 24 compelling arguments for God's existence. And I can't wait to explore all 24 with you today. No, I'm kidding. We're going to boil it down to two main ones. Some of you are like, what did you invite me to, bro? Okay, no. That we're going to look at two evidences today for the existence of God. And these two categories come from a quote by another famous philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who said this. He said, two things awe me the most, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. These are two key evidences for the existence of God. And so we're going to use them today as our categories, the moral law within me and the starry heavens above. And together, they're going to help us to realize that it may be more rational to believe that God exists than that he does not. All right, so let's look first at the moral law within. Those of you who have little kids, or those of you who were little kids at one time, I think that covers all of us, you're probably familiar with some petty bickering from time to time. You got to watch the show you wanted to last night, so I get to watch mine tonight. Or it's my turn, you already had your turn. Or come on, you promised, right? Has anybody heard any of these? And some of you are like, yeah, that sounds like the argument I had with my husband last night. Okay, no. It's interesting that little kids have arguments like this. Because if you notice in all those examples, they seem to be appealing to an unspoken yet agreed upon code of some kind, a set of rules that they seem to know intrinsically. Now, many times these are codes of ethics and fairness that you've never taught them. It almost seems like they and we are predisposed or even hardwired to believe these things. And so we have to ask, why are we moral creatures? For example, if the theory of evolution is true and everything is random, then why do we live with this innate sense of right and wrong? Although differences certainly exist in, you know, certain cultures, virtues like bravery and loyalty and vices like greed and cowardice seem to be almost universal. In fact, in almost every tribe and culture, no matter where it's located in the world, no matter what their history is, loyalty is valued over betrayal, and kindness over meanness, and fidelity over infidelity, sobriety over inebriation, truth-telling over deceitfulness, love over hate. And so many people push back on this idea, and they say, wait, morality is not objective. It's totally subjective to each individual. That what one person believes about right and wrong is true for him and her, or her, but it's not necessarily true for everyone else. And we should never impose our morality on anyone else. What's right for me may not be right for you. This idea is called moral relativism. And here's the problem. If everyone is creating their own morality, the relativist no longer has any leg to stand on. For one thing, if it's true that nobody's supposed to impose their views on anyone else, then the moral relativist shouldn't be imposing moral relativism on the rest of us. You can't even do stuff like yell at somebody when they cut you off in traffic. You can't say that polluting the environment is wrong. You can't say that blowing up a building is wrong. Who are you to impose your morals on someone else who has a different view than you? They're choosing what's right for them. But of course, we do have a sense of these things. We do seem to understand that there is a law or a rule that somehow transcends our cultural values and our human opinions. Paul says it this way in Romans 2:15. He says, they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. What's Paul saying here? He's saying that there seems to be some values deep within us, deeper than what culture can account for. That things like right and wrong are actually coded inside of us, that they're written on our hearts, he says here. And we have these things called consciences that point us towards something deeper than our own experience, that give us guidance in our day-to-day decisions. And what about when our conscience tells us to do something selfless, something sacrificial, which it often does? What happens when your moral code kicks in when you see somebody drowning in Lake Erie on a hot summer day and you're compelled to go and risk your own safety, to risk your life maybe even, to go in after them? We would all agree that this is a good and a right thing to do. There's something in us that says, that's good. The problem is that if we believe in a naturalistic and an evolution-based worldview, that kind of moral code doesn't make any sense. Because the driving principles of evolution say that there's natural selection and survival of the fittest. And so these feelings towards self-sacrifice, they're completely counterproductive to those principles. In fact, sacrificing your own safety for someone else should be seen as a great evil to be avoided and not a great good to be applauded if the goal is survival of the fittest. You see, the whole theory of survival of the fittest is built around the idea of the strong dominating the weak. Charles Darwin himself and some of his early followers took this to its logical conclusion. In fact, the full title of Darwin's work, The Origin of Species from the late 1800s, is actually kept under wraps these days because it's not really convenient. But the full title is this: The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. He contended, for example, that the mentally challenged should not be allowed to marry or reproduce in any way because they will hinder our progress as a species. And by the mid-1900s, people like Adolf Hitler were taking Darwinism to its natural conclusion. And so what is it in us that keeps us from taking it to the same conclusion? This idea of a favored race. Why would we consider it evil and not good? Could it be that there's something written deep within us, in our hearts and on our consciences, that's repelled by the idea of racism and sexism and unequal treatment of the poor and disabled? Because guys, when we hear of injustices occurring in places like Syria, where people are being gassed by their leaders, or when we hear stories of human trafficking, even in our own country, there's something that rises up in us and feels the need for justice and the need for mercy. It feels the opposite of the powerful dominating the weak. Why? Well, it's because we are more than just an animal instinct. There's something inside of us that says that the weak should be cared for. And not just because it's practical for society like a cog in a wheel, but because it's right. Why would we care about things like justice for the poor and alleviating hunger and disease and caring for the environment if this world was caused by accident and that world and everything in it will eventually simply burn up in the death of the sun? You see, a godless worldview undermines any motivation in us to make the world a better place. So the question becomes, if there is no moral force behind the universe, then why are we moral creatures? That's a very condensed version of evidence for the existence of God from the moral law within us. Let's now turn to Kant's second evidence for the existence of God, and that's the starry heavens above. Listen to what Psalm 19, 1 and 2 says. It says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." Now, again, I want to look beyond the Bible for evidence, but can we at least let this scripture set the tone to say that if we will look around us at the creation, at the mountains, at the vast oceans, at the sunsets, at the stars and the planets, that if we're looking, we can see God's glory, the starry heavens above. Now, I want to break this into a couple of different sections. The first thing I want to deal with is the evidence of origins. I introduced this last week, but I just wanted to revisit it for a moment. See, up until 1929, most secular scientists and cosmologists believed that the universe had existed forever, that the universe itself was an uncaused cause. There was no need for a creator. The universe always existed. But then Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe itself actually had a beginning. He discovered that everything in the cosmos, including the galaxies themselves, are moving rapidly away from each other. And the scientific conclusion was that there was some sort of a beginning, a Big Bang. And this Big Bang theory was widely rejected in the scientific community originally, not because of a flaw in the data, but because it would finally admit that something had to have caused the universe to exist in the first place. And that was starting to sound far too similar to the Christian explanation of beginnings. The universe needed a cause outside of itself, almost like a supernatural creation event. Because you see, it's widely agreed upon in the scientific community that something can't come from nothing. And if something begins to exist, then it's dependent upon something outside of itself to cause it to come into existence. Something that sounds an awful lot like God. Now, here's how I want to caution the Christians in the room when it comes to discussions about origins. You see, while we believe in God as the creator, we don't know exactly how he created. Remember last week I said science is perfectly designed to answer how questions, and Christianity is designed to answer who and why questions. The Bible is very clear on who and why, but we have to tread lightly about the how in Genesis 1 and 2, our creation accounts. And here's why. Because Genesis 1 and 2 are poetry. It's not a science book, it's a poem. And we need to be careful about drawing literal conclusions from a poem. You want proof on this? Do this little experiment for me. There's another poem in the Bible, in the Song of Solomon. Guys, when you're putting the moves on your wife this week, here's what I want you to tell her. Tell her nose is like the towers of Lebanon, right? And just see how that works out for you, okay? It's a poem. Poems are meant to evoke imagery and emotion, not to be taken too literally. And so could God have used a sort of evolutionary process to create? Yes. Could he have done it in seven literal days? Yes. Could the earth be old and not young? Absolutely. Could it be young and not old? Yes. Could God have used natural processes to accomplish his miraculous purposes? Yes. In fact, there are other examples in the scriptures in which God used nature to accomplish miracles. One passage in Exodus says that God parted the waters of the Red Sea. But there's another passage that says a strong east wind did it by blowing all night. So how do we harmonize these two passages? Well, God in his might caused a strong east wind to blow all night and part the Red Sea. That doesn't make God's act any less miraculous. So here's what we do know from Genesis 1 and 2, that God created personally. He's not distant. He's not far away. He's involved in the most intimate details. We also know that God created purposefully. Let me clarify terms in this before I give you an example. So microevolution is a scientific fact. It is the process of small incremental developments within one species. And so there are certain bugs that have built up an immunity to pesticides over time. People become taller or faster in certain cultures. Different colors of roses develop to adapt to certain different environments, okay? Macroevolution is a theory that suggests that non-living substances gave rise to the first living material, which reproduced and diversified across species through natural selection to produce all organisms, everything that we know. And so when it comes to God and macroevolution, the rub is this. By definition, the process of macroevolution was wrought with failure. Species would fail and fail and fail and fail and fail and fail and fail. And finally, there would be a breakthrough in one mutation. And then the process of repeated failure starts over again and fail and fail and fail and fail. And then the next mutation is achieved. If God used macroevolution, for example, as his main means of creating, the Bible should read more like this. Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind. And after 387,492,871 attempts, God finally made a mouse that worked. Okay? And this process of repeated failure over and over again, it just doesn't seem to jive with what we know about the character of God. But we know God created personally, and we know he created purposefully. But how he did it, we'll find out one day. The evidence of origins, you see, more and more is pointing to God, because we know that the universe had a beginning. Here's the second clue, and it's the evidence of design. And I want to break this down and give you a few different examples of this, but here's the general idea. Whenever we see design in the world, we assume that there was a designer. I walk through the office wing of this church on a Wednesday morning and I see a new laptop computer sitting on someone's desk. I immediately suspect that a smart person designed that thing. I would never, ever attribute the creation of a laptop computer to a random explosion in an electronics factory. That never even crosses my mind. Right? Whenever I ride in a high-tech airplane taking off the ground and then hurling through the air at 550 miles an hour at 39,000 feet, I'm amazed by the design. I suspect that some brilliant person put significant thought and effort into that magnificent aircraft. I would never, ever reason that an airplane emerged from an Amazonian swamp where it had been forming on its own, cooking and evolving underground for a billion years. Nor do I think that a tornado whipped through a junkyard and put that 747 together by chance, right? In our experience, where there is intricate, highly functioning design, there's always a designer. And our world and our universe, even our own bodies, they show remarkable examples of design. Let me talk about three different areas. Take the field of biology, for example. Scientists tell us that when you look closely at the DNA of any living organism, it is packed with coherent and information-filled code. Not random, but intelligent, structured information. My son is a computer engineering major. He spent weeks this year writing code that would make a diesel engine and a battery engine talk to each other. Incredible amounts of carefully created information. Did you know that a tiny microscopic amoeba has enough structured and meaningful data to fill 30 encyclopedias? That little sucker, as well as all of the rest of us, have been super coded with information. This is profound evidence for the existence of an intelligent mind behind it all. Francis Collins, the American geneticist who leads the Human Genome Project, he calls it the language of God. He points out that an intricate genetic code is built into every single living organism. Think about the complexity involved in that. Collins said it this way. He said, the God of the Bible is also the God of the genome. He can be worshiped in the cathedral or in the laboratory. His creation is majestic and awesome, intricate and beautiful. You see, there's evidence of design in biology. Or let's talk anatomy for a moment. Not in an eighth grade health class kind of way, okay, thankfully, but I want to talk to you about the human eye. The human eye is a marvel. It's made up of 100 million cells. That there are 7 million special vision cones that fire up information to the brain whenever any degree of light comes into the eye. And here's a little trivia. On average, how many shades of color do you suppose that the normal human eye can distinguish between? How many shades of color can be differentiated by the average human eye? You have a guess? You know what the answer is? 1,000. The average human eye can differentiate between 1,000 shades of color. That's way bigger than our Crayola package, right? And beyond that, our eyes have the most sophisticated autofocusing capability ever designed. We can be sitting in a restaurant, and in the space of a millisecond, we can read a menu on the far wall and then focus on the subtle smile forming on the face of our dinner companion and then spot a hair between the leaves of the lettuce in our salad in a millisecond. No man-made device can or will ever be able to match the complexity and sophistication and effectiveness of the human eye. Imagine the time it would take to focus a camera on those three things. And one day after studying the human eye, Charles Darwin, in a moment of candor, wrote these words. He said, this is a direct quote, "To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree." And guys, the human eye is just one component of our marvelously designed bodies. It says nothing about the intricate workings of our lungs and our bacteria fighting forces and our kidneys and the marvel of the human heart and the brain. Do a little research on the functionality of the human brain and you'll get lost in the brilliant complexity of it all. And that's just us. We're just one species among millions of species who are perfectly crafted to function the way we function. There's this little creature called the bombardier beetle. It repels enemies by firing a hot blast of chemicals from two swivel tubes in its tail. And these two chemicals will spontaneously explode when they're mixed together in a laboratory, but apparently the beetle has an inhibitor substance that blocks the explosive reaction until the beetle squirts some of this liquid into its combustion chambers, where an enzyme is added there to catalyze the reaction. And this amazing mechanism, it points to a designer. You see, science itself tells us that when something is left on its own, it's going to move from a state of order to a state of disorder. This is the second law of thermodynamics. It will begin the process of dispersing and deteriorating. And so if you take a bottle of perfume and you spray it, you'll see that concentrated liquid go from a state of order to disorder. And soon it will be dispersed to the point where you don't even smell it in the air anymore. It's so diluted. Everything is moving toward a state of deterioration. If you don't believe me, kids, go home today and pull out your parents' high school yearbook. You'll see how things deteriorate over time. It's a terrible thing. Anyway, macroevolution minus God would suggest that this scientific law, the second law of thermodynamics, was violated billions of times as by pure chance, cells miraculously organize themselves to form mechanisms like the human eye and the bombardier beetle firing chamber. And as intelligent people, it is time for us to confess the obvious, that wherever and whenever something manifests all the signs of intelligent design, whether it's a bird in flight, a spawning salmon soaring upstream, a sequoia tree reaching for the sky, whenever and wherever we witness the wonder of an intelligent design, I think we should all just admit our suspicion that there has to be an intelligent designer behind it all. Because I don't care how many billions of years you give all these tiny specific factors a chance to develop by random chance, it's not enough time. And science tells us it doesn't work like that. Well, let's come back to astronomy to wrap it up. Scholars tell us that the probability of the universe coming into existence in the way that it has, perfectly fine-tuned for human life, is 10 to the 138th power. It's mathematically impossible. And on top of that, there were 26 variables exactly tuned for our universe to exist to support life. So imagine 26 dials lined up in a long row along a wall. And if one of them was turned just a hair, just off by one part in a million millionth, there would have been no galaxies, no stars, no planets, no people. This has been called the fine-tuning argument. Atheist Stephen Hawking, a famous physicist and cosmologist, admitted this. He said, "The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications. It would be very difficult," he said, "to explain why the universe would have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us." Now, there are a lot of fierce rebuttals being published about this argument. The most common is from Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion. He says that given that there are trillions of universes existing over enormous amounts of time and space, that it's inevitable that some of them are fine-tuned to sustain our kind of life. But we come back to a common sense question. Where does the evidence lead us? Is that the most probable explanation? Philosopher John Leslie proposed a helpful illustration. He said, imagine a man who is sentenced to be executed by a firing squad. That firing squad consists of 50 of the top expert marksmen in the world. All 50 of those marksmen are only 6 feet away from the man, and they fire their rifles simultaneously. And an amazing thing happens. Not one bullet of the 50 hits him. Since it is possible that even expert marksmen could miss from close range, it is technically possible that all 50 just happened to miss on the same shot by complete chance. It is theoretically possible. But a far more reasonable and rational explanation would be that those 50 marksmen had conspired to miss the man. And so while it's technically possible that we just so happen to be in the one universe in which organic life occurred by some infinitely remote chance, we have to ask, is that really the best explanation? Or could it be that the evidence leads us, not just the Bible, but the evidence all around us, leads us to conclude that maybe, just maybe, it's more rational to believe that God exists than that he does not? See, my personal belief in a personal creator has never seemed like a mindless leap of faith to me. In fact, just the opposite. There's kind of a duh factor here. It just seems like the most reasonable explanation for all the evidence. Everywhere you look in this world, you see intelligent processes and designs, from photosynthesis in plants to complex migrating patterns in birds, to astonishing breathing systems in fish and sea creatures. And to me, intellectual integrity demands that we assume that every intelligent design involved an intelligent designer, unless there's overwhelming data to the contrary. See, there's a sweeping narrative today that it is irrational and ignorant to believe in God, that only the uneducated and emotionally unstable people need something like God to fall back on. And everyone who's truly rational and intelligent believes there's no God. But I would respond like this. If you don't allow for God, you're basically saying that you are staking your life on this equation. Nobody times nothing equals everything. And when you think of it like that, maybe the people who believe in God aren't the irrational ones. Maybe they're the ones who are actually following the evidence where it truly leads. You would have to break so many scientific laws and theories to conclude that all of this just happened by chance, that it seems to require far more blind faith than the Christians are accused of. Former atheist Lee Strobel shared this insightful tweet almost a year ago. He said, "To continue in atheism, I needed to believe that nothing produces everything, non-life produces life, randomness produces fine-tuning, chaos produces information, unconsciousness produces consciousness, and non-reason produces reason, and I simply didn't have that much faith." I want to encourage you today to take two simple next steps this week. The first is this. Again, we're getting no kickback from this, but I think it's just such a helpful resource. I'd encourage you to pick up your copy of The Problem of God by Mark Clark. If you're a regular around here, purchase it from Amazon or Kindle or wherever you get your books. And if you're a first-time guest with us today at one of our physical locations, you can pick up a free copy at our Next Step Center. Our first 100 first-time guests this whole month will get a free book just for joining us. And I'd encourage you to invest 2 more hours on 2 more Sundays this month and join us for the last couple installments of this series. Here's the second. I want to challenge you to have a conversation with somebody this week about God's existence. Talk about this. I mean, I shared a lot of information today. I get it. So you can go back and catch the message again at whoisgrace.com if you want to pause it and take a couple notes here and there so that you have some points of discussion and conversation. But go ahead and road test this stuff. Find a friend or a family member, maybe someone who's not part of this church, maybe not part of any church, and just ask them, what do they think about the existence of God? And guys, no pressure to convince them or evangelize them or argue with them. Just have a good conversation about some of this stuff. Test yourself. Bring some facts, bring some evidence to the table, and just see where it all leads. Where are the objections? Where could you go back and do some research on your own? I think it would be helpful for all of us. And so I close today in the same way I began, with a question for us to ponder. What if it's actually more rational to believe that God exists than that he doesn't? God bless you.